Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's happiest podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George Demorelis. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show we have Lee Smales, who has worked at Citigroup for several years trading short-term interest rate derivatives before moving to Australia to lecture, starting at UNSW and then Curtin University. And now you're based in UWA lecturing in financial markets. How are you doing, Lee?
Pretty good, George.
I feel like I was looking at you as I was saying all that, and I feel like you were... I was getting a vibe like you were actually kind of impressed that I managed to say it all correctly.
No, I was amazingly impressed that you got it in the right order, and particularly the trading at Citigroup.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I actually studied finance. I spent a short time in banking as well.
Okay.
Yeah. And I went through a phase where I really liked... I find finance as a topic very interesting, like the story of it, because obviously it defines so much of the world. So, yeah, you can't be a history fan or be interested in the world and not kind of have a good appreciation of how finance works and economics and all that stuff. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it drives a lot of what we do today, and obviously a lot of historical events are driven by economics and finance. Yeah, so it's pivotal to what we do.
Yeah, exactly. And I think like, yeah, definitely. So I think one of the things that stands out to me straight before we go into the book even is you got a very clean split in your like background, like your CV, I guess, because you went from trading and then you just went to academia.
Maybe the resume doesn't do it complete justice. I was trading. I first came to Australia working with Citigroup trading, and then sort of the GFC hit and there was a restructuring. And so I used my initial, I guess, goal was to use academia as a sort of a stop off before getting back into the markets. But then I actually really enjoyed the research and then engaging with students as well. And so I ended up staying with the academia. Really enjoy it.
That's like, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, obviously, because it's very, I feel like they're almost polar opposite things in some ways, like the culture and the vibe of it and all that.
Oh, definitely the culture is different. The financial aspect is really quite different in terms of the compensation.
Yeah, I could imagine as well. Yeah.
But the you know, the intellectual stimulation is still there. The thing that attracted me to trading really in the first place wasn't necessarily the Ferraris and the Porsches. It was the, you know, the thought of trying to beat the market and coming up with ideas to trade and benefit from different economic aspects. And just like with research, it's all about figuring out how things piece together and coming up with solutions. So there's some overlap, even though it is certainly different pressures and different clientele.
Yeah, look, I like you're on the right podcast to go from trading to be like, I'm going to be an academic, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone here's going to love that a lot.
The other things, well, trading was amazingly fun and I had a brilliant time and made some very good friends, some of my best friends. But it obviously comes with different pressures and that lifestyle isn't for everybody, certainly not for prolonged periods of time. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. So some of the occurrences that happened in that movie were sort of pretty close to home back when I was trading.
Ah, so now you're just making everyone jealous. I feel like, the GFC, I think, is a very clean split, though, between maybe how crazy it was and then what it kind of became now versus,
Yeah, things definitely changed. Well, already changing in the early 2000s, some of the stories that I was told by people who'd been there for longer periods of time, certainly back in the 80s, that seemed sort of like a different level. Mm. But things were changing in the early 2000s. Companies were becoming more cautious about what their employees were up to. And then certainly since 2008, things have absolutely changed. Mm. It's a different world.
So really, you just were like, the party's over. I'm out, guys.
Yeah.
Something wild enough anymore.
Something like that. Don't tell my wife.
It's all right. You've calmed down. It's fine. It's all right. Okay, cool. Well, then, so let's start with the book, and then we'll kind of jump around from there. Your book of choice for today is
Around the World in 80 Days.
Yeah, by Jules Verne.
Correct.
An absolute classic. Like, I don't even know if I feel the need to have to clarify. For anyone who doesn't know, a guy makes a wager about going around the world in 80 days, and then he goes on misadventures to get around the world in 80 days. It's a gentleman in England, and he's valet who's
French,
and is it just meant to be a pun on passport?
Basically, passepartout. Yeah, so yeah. It's a pun on passport. I would say.
Yeah.
Of course, he rescues a princess on the way.
Of course, you got to. I mean, this is
yeah.
Nice. Yeah, that's sweet. This was like, because and also this was the 19th century. It was like 18. I think I looked up 1860 or something like that. It was written.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. 1870s or something. Yeah, 19th century for sure. I think it was sort of coinciding with the transcontinental railway in the US and things like that. Mm. That had sort of made the journey feasible. So it's sort of historic. I've got a love of history. I've got a love of travel and adventure. So it sort of brings things together.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things when I was thinking back on it, because I think I read it years ago, and I was kind of like, one of the things that stands out is like, it can be weird. I don't know how to describe it. It's like, it's got a very positive view of technology and the world coming together in a sense. Like that's how Jules Verne kind of writes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's I think a few of his books sort of do that, sort of like traveling to the moon and things like that. It's about harnessing technology for the positives. And yeah, in this case, it's obviously trains and, not planes or automobiles, but trains and boats and elephants and things, basically anywhere to get around the world. And I think it also uses telegrams or telegraphs, which would have been pretty new back then. Huh. So it's cutting edge technology. It's just a great sort of almost a feel-good story, you might say. And of course, without spoiling the end for listeners, of course he manages to win the wager.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that's literally the definition of spoiling the ending. But anyways,
sorry.
Spoiling the ending, here's the last.
Without
page.
Spoiling the ending, I will absolutely spoil the ending.
Yeah, that's right. But, I think it's 150 years old. I think we're allowed.
I think people are will. And I read it as a kid. The first time I read it was a child. I must have been, seven or eight when I first read it. And it's inspired definitely a love of travel or a desire to travel and sort of go to exotic places and things. And fortunately, my later years, I've been able to do that.
All right. So you've done a bit of getting around the globe, seeing lots of things?
Well, until the last 18 months.
Obviously,
one of my big bugbears with the restrictions that we have. But yeah, I've managed to travel to a lot of places, particularly around Asia, and North America. And of course, growing up in the UK and living in London, I've traveled to a lot of Europe before ending up in the most remote city in the world.
It's a fact. Yes. Interesting choice. You're like, I'm done. No more people. you're saying that though. So you didn't grow up in London. You're from
So I'm from the northeast of England originally. So the nearest big town would be it's a place called Middlesbrough, which what are the claims to fame? Captain Cook was born there.
Okay.
The steel for the Harbour Bridge in Sydney was from there. That's about the only claims to fame. That it's had a reasonably successful football team at one point with several Australians playing for it.
I like how all Mark the claims Schwarzer, seem to relate to Australia.
Mark Schwarzer and Mark, yeah. Well, those I'm trying to.
You're pandering.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we are loving it.
But it's on the coast in the northeast of England, about halfway between York and Newcastle. Mm. If people have heard of those places,
Did you
about 250 miles north of London?
Okay, yeah. Also known as nothing in Melbourne, but also known as the whole world when in Europe. So, yeah, I know.
Yes.
Entirely different regions. Yeah. In Melbourne, it's like, oh, I've got to go and see my friend. He's 250 kilometers away. You're actually not out of the state yet. Yeah.
Well, try Perth. When I moved to Perth from Sydney, we drove across, and that's 4,200 kilometers. If you're in Europe, you're essentially driving across Europe into Greece or somewhere. It's from London, so it's quite, you know, the distances here are extraordinary.
Yeah,
growing up in the UK,
and then like on that drive, you'd pass through about 50 different cultures and places and regions, and here it's just like a straight road. Like
yeah.
Which is
cool. And the accents. One thing that I find amusing here is sort of the limited number of accents, whereas in the UK you can go 20 kilometers and there's almost a completely different accent.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting part, yeah. I mean, obviously just because you've been around there so long. I like to play around with those English accents. They're quite fun. I've got a soft spot for one near you, like the Yorkshire-ish sort of one, like Northern
English. Yeah, Yorkshire.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
Yeah, so my family are mainly from Yorkshire. So Middlesbrough is just in North Yorkshire. The River Tees, which Middlesbrough is just south of, separates Yorkshire from Durham, and that's where my family are from. So, some of my family have very strong Yorkshire accents. They sound like they're from the TV show Last of the Summer Wine.
Nice. Well, that's an obscure reference, I feel like, for a lot of people, but that's a whole vibe. So, like, I actually on that point, because like it's something which stuck out to me, because you mentioned it with a few of the books you were saying when we were talking before in the emails before the show started, and you're talking about how like specifically one of the other books you're looking at was Great Expectations, but about its working class attitude coming in. And I think that's interesting, because like the picture I'm kind of building already is that you read this book in terms of Around the World in 80 Days, about travel and about getting out and seeing the world. And I'm just wondering, was that a contrast with maybe growing up in Middlesbrough? And it's not exactly the most regular Middlesbrough ambition for a lot of people.
I mean, Middlesbrough is a very industrial town. So steel works and chemical works and things like that. And growing up, traveling more than sort of 10 miles away would seem to be a bit of an odd thing for people to do. And I always had, I guess, bigger vision of things and wanted to travel and not necessarily just get out, but experience new things and have an adventure. I had a great childhood, and I had loved playing sport and going into the countryside and things as a kid, but I knew there was so much more out there. And one of the other books I mentioned was Great Expectations. I know one of the things in that is, you know, Pip gets his education paid for, and he uses that as a sort of a, a, a segue to meet these great expectations. And that's sort of, for me growing up, that was one of the things I saw, a good education as one way of breaking the barriers.
Yeah, and the cycles
sort of exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, breaking the cycle, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's that kind of set you apart from your family, but like not in a negative way, you just wanted to go do that instead.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I grew up in a working class family. My I'm the first person in my family to go to university. Obviously now got a doctorate as well, so I was the first person to be in my family to have a PhD. But I think as well as books, my grandfather was a great influence on me as a kid. He was a single parent for quite a long time. Came from a single parent family for quite a long time. Initially, my mum remarried when I was at secondary school. So my granddad was a big influence. Always encouraged me to read and play sport and do well at school. And he grew up at a time when so he would have been a teenager in the 40s, and he went off to war and saw some of the world through that, and always encouraged me to go out and do the same. Well, not necessarily go to war, but see the world.
Yeah, okay. In a slightly safer way. That's
yeah.
I mean, you're painting such a. I got to say right now, you're painting such a like cliche picture of like the boy from the small town, like is in it. I'm picturing your parents in like coal mining hats, almost like industrial.
That was my wife's parents. My wife grew up in a small coal mining village about 20 miles north in Durham.
Oh, really?
So she is literally she's from just about the next village. Just about is where Billy Elliot was filmed.
Okay.
So Easington. Okay. Yeah.
So that is literally
where she's from.
That is hilarious.
And I'm from somewhere that's not too dissimilar to that.
I love it. It's literally the picture, the postcard of what the coal mining town with the kid who wants to get out and sort of ambitions.
Yeah, that's it.
That's amazing.
I couldn't dance like Billy Elliot though. So
yeah, she had to go study. I love that story. Firstly, it's great, and I think it's always beautiful when you can like want to do more. So you're saying your grandpa kind of helped you guide in that direction.
Yeah, that's right.
So this book, I guess that's what I'm finding interesting. Like, I love when it's a story like this where it's like, this hits you on that emotional core thing from when you were younger. Even from then you're like, I want to leave. Did you know you wanted to do finance technically, or was it like? Which sounds weird as a 10-year-old. I'm going to be a trader, but you know what I mean.
Well, not necessarily being a trader, but I was interested in the way that things work and fit together. So, you know, things like how watches, the movements in watches work and things like that. And so it sounds strange, but economics is sort of like that. You know, you change one input and then something happens via a system and you have a particular output, you know, so like that's how monetary policy works. You know, you change interest rates and something happens to economic output and inflation. So it was more not necessarily finance but economics I was interested in from admittedly a very early age. I was one of those sad kids that was sat reading the Times and the Financial Times as a probably no exaggeration 11 or 12.
Oh my god!
Sat so I'm fortunate that I was sort of 5'10" by the time I was 11. I'm over 6 foot now. So otherwise, I think I might have been one of those nerdy kids who got picked on at school. But fortunately, I was quite sporty and quite large, so that prevented that from happening, despite my nerdiness.
Yeah, yeah. That's That is, okay, I didn't expect it to be that early on. An interesting economics. That's amazing. Like, I know what you mean. It like I said, and as you said at the start, as a student, if you like history in the world, and it's funny, even travel, like just seeing how it all connects. And then, like, I feel like, yeah. It really slots into that.
Travel and trade and think all related, and they're essentially economic tools. So if you think about it, a lot of these things happen because, yeah.
Marriage is just a good thing to do economically. That's the only reason.
Well, some people would argue that. Marriage is one, but divorce is obviously the opposite.
Yeah. I love that. Staying together the worst thing it doesn't make do. Economic sense to do otherwise. That's great. Well, I mean, but it's true. Like, seeing how that slots together, it's funny you come to that from obviously where you grew up, and then you moved to London, and you would have studied first and then traded. And this is part, again, because of, we had this discussion before the show, and the few of the books you chose, which was like Sherlock Holmes and Around the World in 80 Days. Yeah.
They have London in them.
Pardon? They have London in them. Yeah, that as well, which is, to be fair. But, like, firstly, they're all classics, like old classics. So is that something you always kind of preferred, or is that just – are you trying to fake it for the book crowd? You're like, I read classic books, guys.
No, I do like modern books. So one of the other books I mentioned that I've read recently is Honey Bee. Mm. But I do like the classics and yeah, just growing up, those were probably the ones that were sort of more accessible in the, you know, in the library and things. It was all, I was going to say online. Clearly online didn't exist when I was growing up.
Yeah,
just, I like to read a variety of books, and definitely nonfiction books or biographies, particularly political memoirs, and travel memoirs and. Yeah, a whole variety of books. Mm. The only books that sometimes the books that are really slow and painstaking to get into, and people insist and that say just keep trying, you know, it'll be great in the end. And it's always so disappointing when they're not.
Do you have an example? I love that. I definitely want to hear that. Oh,
hopefully my friend doesn't listen to this podcast, but she bought me it for Christmas. And it was about, it won Pulitzer Prize, and it was about trees.
Aha, uh-huh. Yeah. I actually
read that. How they're all interconnected and mm-hmm. And
the overstory.
The start of it I really enjoyed. It was about, this was sort of almost the reverse of books that I dislike, because the start of it I really enjoyed. It was about history, the history of trees and how they communicate and things. And there was like disparate stories. And I thought, oh, this is going to come together nicely. And then it was, I don't know, it just went, for a start, it went on for a long time. And any book that you can use as a door wedge, I think is probably not a good start, but it just sort of, yeah. That wasn't a favorite.
Yeah. Okay. And that's
I'm probably not explaining myself very well.
No. I know exactly what you mean, because the story, it started off with the very short cutting in between the different people's stories.
Yes.
And then about halfway, it kind of switched into now just a kind of regular, more classic story narrative structure.
Yeah, which I didn't.
See, that's interesting. I thought it was really good. I thought it really captured, it made you like trees and appreciate hippies.
It did, but it was, the hippies, and I just didn't, I enjoyed the start of it, but I think that was my love of history and facts and things that I enjoyed in that section.
Yeah, it's like, this is some good facts, all right. And it's like, oh, no, narrative? I don't have time for this. Give me the facts.
I think the pace slowed too much. Mm. So the books that I've mentioned, so you mentioned the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, that's a series of short stories, mm-hmm. essentially. Around That World in 80 Days is a reasonably short book that's quite fast-paced. So I think that maybe, I think my brain sort of goes off on other journeys whilst I'm reading, so it makes me a bit too impatient for books.
For anything too long.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay. And you were focused on markets for that long? Okay. Naturally, because there's a lot more going on to engage you.
Well, there's a lot more going on. There's flashing lights and screens and numbers are moving all of the time. and there's news and
That's a I mean, like I get what you mean. I mean, I think it just it's different people like different things. That's totally
fair enough. Yeah.
The other part as well, and this might just be because you were reading books which are more classic, and those are what you picked. But the other thing that stood out to me, and it kind of ties in, and I'm totally pulling this out of my butt, but like you're as someone coming from like the background you did going to London, there is an element of like that big smoke, like the outsider coming in, and I am. Even before, obviously, even before you went there, there is that element where maybe there was a bit of wish, not wish fulfillment, but like you're looking at these genteel gentlemen mainly is your stories. That's what the ones you've picked. They're all very much of the upper crust in terms of what they're doing. Not just saying this and you want to be a upper crust person, but in terms of like culturally and stuff, they're very cultured and worldly and that's very much a part of who they are.
That's a good point, Ivan.
I just wondered if that was a thing. I don't know if that was something.
I haven't really thought about it, but you're right. You know the definitely Phileas Fogg was an English gentleman, and Holmes is a gent as well. I don't know if it's necessarily something in Great Expectations, Pip becomes a gentleman. I don't know if it's something that I aspire to. I mean, I think when I, again, linking back to my grandfather, he was a real gentleman, I would describe him as. And, maybe that's something that I aspire to. My wife would probably say I failed on that part.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you're like in the morning. You know?
I am still in, you know, you mentioned about moving away and getting out and not being typical of my background. So I am still in touch with some friends, very few from school. And when we occasionally have a catch up online, they tell me all that's going on. And very few people even went to university from my school, never mind ended up living away afterwards. So most people still sort of live in the same area, haven't really. So, and that's fine. That's their life. But it's, so I've definitely had different aspirations. And whether that's been a gentleman or not, but certainly improving myself, I think, is a different way of. Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying you want to...
be a country gent wearing my barber jacket and going shooting at weekends and things.
Yeah, I don't mean that.
Although I do have friends who do that. That's, that wasn't my main aspiration.
Really? I love hearing that. That's just, like, so far outside my...
Certainly. Well, living in London and working in the markets, that certainly attracts people from that background to some extent. We definitely had friends who had country places and, we went shooting at weekends and things. Clear pigeon shooting, I should add, not shooting of actual animals.
Okay. True. It's good to add actually. Everyone's picturing that. So this is amazing. This is such a different world that you've gone kind of through and then you've come to academia at the end. But that's what I mean. So you ended up actually hanging out with the people that you were kind of reading about, I guess, in a weird way.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, in some way.
But yeah, actually, just to go on that topic of the finance and the transition to academia for a second, just because I did notice one of your papers that you wrote recently. So there's actually two things I want to ask about here, because we haven't really gone into the academia side of the finance stuff. So firstly, I noticed you've written up in a few journals. You've had some pieces done. Just because, look, it's writing, and I do find that interesting. But like, is that process, is that like, what's involved in that program? How thorough do you have to be, and how like detailed is it when you get written up in those things? Like, are you like, how much do you have to show you're working, I guess?
Okay. So to some extent, it depends on the journal, but so clearly you have to, you gather data, you perform statistical tests. And so a lot of it, writing a paper for an academic journal is two aspects. The first one is generally reviewing the current literature and theories, spotting gaps in that literature and different hypotheses to test. Then you gather data to test that and go through statistical tests and then write up those tests and draw some conclusions. So depending on the journal may, so it sends it out to other academics, essentially, so peers to review. And they may be happy enough with just the demonstration that you've got in the tables, statistical tables, that, you know, things seem to fit together and work, and that's sufficient evidence. But more and more now, they actually require you to upload all of the data, or at least part of the data, the coding and programming that you've developed in order to analyze the data, and also share that with the peer reviewers and the more generally the public, so that others can go and test, so that they can see that what you have reported is actually consistent with the data. And that's more and more becoming prevalent, that this replication, because there's been some issues in recent times with essentially people falsifying results.
Oh, so it's actually falsifying results. So I thought it might be
some people
not doing it right, rather than.
Yeah, so some people, I say falsify maybe too strong word, but let's inaccurately reporting, making errors in the data and things like that. So that's certainly an issue with some places around the world. So I think it's a good idea to make the data more available and such like. So, and it ensures helps to ensure integrity in the process. So I think it's a great idea.
I 100% agree. I think this is an interesting topic for me. So I know, I'm sure a lot of people listening have probably already gone like heard data and statistics too much to find this as exciting as I do. But it's because from my understanding, there actually has been quite a big replication error issue with a lot of this stuff in recent years, across a lot of spectrums of academia, I guess, not just economics.
Yeah, absolutely. So the replication issue is being noticed across the whole spectrum. So not just finance and other business or social studies, but in the physical sciences and across the full spectrum, it's been recognized as an issue. But one of the problems is that when you write a paper, you're supposed to provide enough information in that paper for somebody else to come along, gather the same data, and then replicate what you've done and get the same results. Part of the issue is when you write about the process that you followed, some of the process that you follow is sort of almost implicit, and because you've done this before, and you miss some of the steps in the writing. So you've actually followed through with certain steps and certain decisions about the data and how to handle the data, but you don't note absolutely every step. So then when somebody else comes along and tries to follow what you've actually written, then they get something slightly different. So I think that's an issue.
Oh.
There's a paper that came out, I think last year or the year before, where they took a group of neuroscientists, gave them all of this same group of data, and asked them to make conclusions based on this data. And they got a wide variety of results. I've just been involved in a study by the same guys where you're given a bunch of financial data and asked to answer questions using this data. And because you're limited by the data that you have access to, you need to make assumptions and you need to make decisions about what you're going to do with the data. And so just like with the neuroscientists, there's a wide spectrum of answers with the finance data. Not necessarily the direction of the results, but the magnitude of the results. Mm. So, you know, you could get a positive result, but one person might say it's 90%, whereas another person might say it's 30%
yeah.
positive. So it's an interesting issue.
I'm partially into the growth of this kind of stuff. And just fascinating because it's like, we don't know what's going on. Like, is it all these studies and stuff we thought was, but obviously it's not to that degree, but it is an interesting little realization people are having right now that this is, that a lot of the stuff we might've taken as for granted maybe isn't quite as for granted as we thought.
Yeah. I mean, I think that unfortunately that does create issues with sort of some of the drama around COVID and the misrepresentation of certain data and things that people use at the moment.
It definitely brings it front and center, definitely, that side of things, I think. Although, I don't know if anyone who's complaining about the COVID results has read many neuroscience papers and debates about the population sizes or something like that.
No, that's right.
They're like, excuse me, this economics paper had a 2-sigma normal distribution, so I think COVID's wrong. I feel like not the same kind of very limited Venn diagram crossover there.
I actually think the COVID issue, the sort of misinformation about COVID, it sort of highlights one issue that happens in scientific journals, is that an article can be published and then subsequently be shown to be false or incorrect, some errors with it, and so retracted by the journal. But those results are already sort of out there and are sort of pounced upon. And I think that sort of happened with a couple of the sort of misinformation around the treatment that Trump was spouting. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, people jumping the gun. I know.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
The thing that I don't understand, people are very happy to take horse-worming tablets, but not on the basis of one study, but not happy to have a vaccination on the basis of a multitude of studies.
Yeah, I think the funniest part for me is like...
puzzles me.
Yeah, someone pointed out to me, actually. They go, it doesn't... If you're anti-pharmacy, you know what? You're still wrong, you could say, but at least you've got some consistency. Yeah. But if your issue is like, I'll buy from this pharmacy instead of that pharmacy, like, what's your issue now? Like, as in, it's the same company selling you both, except one has less people assessing whether it's good or not. Like, as in, it just seems to not make much sense. Yeah. They're just like, I just want to be different, guys. It's an entire political movement. Look, the analysis stuff is interesting to me, just because, economics has a complicated history, I feel like, as in it tried to get treated like a science for a while quite properly, and now I think they kind of stepped back from that degree. Is that fair to say, or is that still the case? Or
well, some people would argue, some of my colleagues would probably argue with you, but I agree. I think it's, you know, it's a social science. It's almost more of a we do use data and base things on statistics, but it's definitely, it's an if it's a science, it's an imperfect science for sure. It's and more of a, certainly some things are more of an art than a science. I think one of the issues is, you know, so you mentioned the GFC earlier. Yeah. I think economists or at least the public and the media held up economists as, you know, they should be able to predict these things. I don't think that's necessarily what we set out to do. It's maybe not too helpful, but I think what economists really are trying to do is help to explain what happened or what's happening, rather than predict what's going to happen. That may not be entirely helpful, but hopefully if we understand what's happened in the past, we can help to predict or understand what's happening in the future, and certainly how to respond to things. I think an example of that, lessons learned, it would be sort of March last year when the COVID sort of pandemic first sort of started, had a response in the economy, how central banks around the world responded to the sort of liquidity crunch and credit crunch within financial markets. They sort of took lessons from the GFC and sort of provided lots of additional liquidity, so lots of extra cash into the market to support it. I think that's created problems of its own, but it's still was very helpful at the time.
Yeah, that's why you've actually picked a very good, I think, a golden example, just because how much it captures what you mean. Because I think that was all, I mean, not that he did it himself, but what's his name, that billionaire that wrote that book about Ray Dalio, I just remembered. So this is a good example because he's kind of gone and become like a real proponent of this attitude of always the risk is liquidity crunching and then that causing an issue. But I'm actually interested, I don't even know if this will stay in the episode because it's it's just esoteric for most people. Obviously, that on paper, that makes sense, right? You're like, oh, the issue here is that liquidity stopped running the market and then that's what caused kind of the crunch that happened. But obviously, that's based on the idea that we're not actually seeing the full impact of that stuff in terms of from a 5-year perspective or something, or 20-year perspective. So I'm just wondering, do you have any opinion on that? Do you reckon, like, as in, like you said, it's imperfect, but is it so imperfect that it's too dangerous to use?
Well, so all of these sort of mechanisms, monetary policy mechanisms, or, you know, the fiscal policy actions, sort of like a job seeker and things like that, helping to support the economy. The intention, I think, is to stabilize the economy during a panic, so that things don't get as bad as they could have otherwise. I think the issue becomes, I think this is a really big issue for asset prices at the moment, when the liquidity and cash is just so cheap. So money is so cheap that because it's flooding around the market, that asset prices just zoom and just keep going up and up. And then so every time that there's another crisis, well, the response before that original liquidity has been withdrawn, the response is just add more liquidity. So then that just pushes asset prices further. So it becomes like a self-fulfilling cycle to some extent. So the question is, where does that end?
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why house prices are so ridiculously high, not just here in Australia, but in other places around the world, is because central banks make money cheap and borrowing cheap. And so what do people do? They borrow more, invested in assets. They don't save because you get nothing on your savings. So you put it into other assets. And so housing, stock prices are all-time highs. It's despite the pandemic, stock prices are all-time highs. It's incredible. So the concern is what happens when that's withdrawn. So they talk about the Federal Reserve or the central bank taking away the punch bowl from the party.
That's what seems to me like the other side, which I think all these people talk about, like the desire for liquidity, but it's like, Like, I mean, I make a joke with my friend. He's a hedge fund trader, and I'm like, it's done. Just buy, because there's no dips anymore. Because if there's a dip, they're just going to print money and it's going up. So the world's gone crazy. The worse the news, the more you should buy, because it's going to skyrocket even more. Like
it's crazy. It's almost, so it's almost feels like the end to economic cycles in some way, or at least in asset price cycles. Yeah. So I just can't see that it goes for forever. There's got some correction, but, you know, I mean, the other argument, and this was what, you know, even back when John Maynard Keynes was recommending fiscal intervention during the Depression and things, the argument would be it's better just to let the market respond to these events, and then it might be a deep cut, but it's a short and quick cut, and then things recover. Whereas now, just the situation builds. Mm. So eventually, what do we have?
That's where it's like, I don't know.
So one other aspect that it creates is, and Japan in the 90s and subsequent is probably a good example of that, is we have zombie firms that if they were, the government allowed them to fail, if they weren't putting so much additional stimulus into the economy, they would fail, and then the economy would eventually recover from that. But so at the moment, we've got firms that are probably alive just because they can access debt so easily.
Hmm.
And really, they've got no business to keep going. But
yeah, it's I don't know. The topic is, look, and this is what you traded as well in terms of debt. That's why the whole thing is...
Exactly.
Like, I mean, this is like talking of debt. I just very rarely get to talk to someone of your caliber about it. Like, as in, I remember when I was in university, he was talking about a debt financing, and one of the examples he gave, and it scarred me for life in a way. But he was talking about when Kraft bought Cadbury. I think it was Kraft bought Cadbury, and it was like Cadbury was a much, much bigger company, but it was so well managed that it didn't have much debt. So what this smaller company did was do the classic thing that now everyone knows, a leverage buyout, where they just go, we'll just borrow against the company and buy it and then put the debt on it. So it's like, this isn't good for anyone. Like, it's making a worse company, and it just seems wrong in a weird way.
That's sort of an example of financial innovation gone wrong.
Yeah.
There was a really, thinking of books, there was a really good book called Barbarians at the Gate, which was written about a famous leverage buyout in the US for a firm called RJR Nabisco. And I think they might have subsequently been bought by Kraft. So they had two parts of it. They had a tobacco part and a sort of a food component. Biscuits and things like that. And so the book is all about the sort of the race for the leveraged buyout for that, and how these investment banks got involved, and there were some interesting characters in that story. So it's a really interesting read, I thought.
Mm. Barbarians of the Gate. I think I've heard of that, actually. Yeah.
Barbarians of the Gate, yeah.
We've gone completely off topics. It's interesting. Maybe some listeners will find it interesting too. to go back for a second to that discussion we're having about the gentlemanly read of those books. So like I was saying, it's interesting to see that kind of, because I'm not even thinking of it in terms of genteel or even this ostentatiousness of, let's say, the markets and maybe certain elements of gentlemanly culture. But I was thinking more like the cultured sense, the worldly sense, which seems to have appealed to you as well. Just the getting out and expanding your mind, which is all these characters have. And you've already mentioned academia so many times.
Well, one of the things that I absolutely loved about living in London was the cultural side of it, and you know, being able to go to the open air theatre in Regent's Park, and being able to go, to the West End and see a musical, and all of the galleries, and the National Gallery and the British Museum, and all of those things, which a lot of the museums and galleries were free as well. So it was a great way to sort of while away a few a few hours. And because they were free, you could just go in, look at a section of it and come back another time and look at another section, particularly the British Museum, such a brilliant building and establishment. So I love that about London, all of the culture.
No, I agree. I think it can be overwhelming, but obviously, yeah, it's amazing as well, that side of things. And look, I've got to say, I'm glad I've had quite a few people who've been Perth-based on this show, and a lot of the time it's them leaving Perth, and a lot of the time it's them having comments about what they've, you know, why they left. So it's very nice to have someone who's gone from London to Perth. That's a nice promo for the city. Yeah.
It's, well, as you hopefully saw in the AFL Grand Final production, where it was had all of the flyovers and things. I thought it was a really good tourist advert for their city. It's a beautiful place to live.
And just like lifestyle-wise, it just doesn't get much better.
And I that's sort of the way I sum up Perth to a lot of people, ignoring the cultural side of things, that it's the, you know, in Sydney, if you wanted to go to the beach, first it took ages to get there driving. Then you had to try and find a parking spot. If you found a parking spot, it was sort of $8 an hour to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And then you couldn't take your dog on the beach either. Here, it takes no time to get there because there's no traffic. There's loads of parking spots. They're free. And you can take your dog to a lot of the beaches. Mm-hmm. So that's just, life is so much easier.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's just such a lifestyle cycle thing. You start off wanting one thing and then you like obviously go overboard and go to, let's say, London especially, and then do that and then for a while. Then you're like, actually, I kind of like, there's still enough culture here and I can kind of like being able to walk around and not have to wait in traffic for 50 hours to get anything.
It is. I mean, they say that British people like queuing. That's a fallacy, at least from my point of view. British people are forced to queue because there's so many people living on a quite small island, or relatively small island. I hate queuing. And so, you know, one of the things that I really disliked about Sydney before was the increase in restaurants that you couldn't book a table. So the whole thing was you had to come and wait outside.
Oh, mate.
And, you know, that was the, you know, the cool thing about it.
Yeah,
that is not cool. That is stupid. Thankfully, that has not taken hold here in Perth.
It's been about 10 years. It might be back. No, that's, I 100% agree. I think it's one of those things where people don't realize how, you just don't have to put up with that. Just walk in. It's so much easier.
the definitely in the 10 years that I've been here, 10 years, 8. Oh, when did I come here? 8 years I've been here in Perth. The food and the cultural part of things have definitely improved, particularly the food. When we first moved here, it was very difficult to get a sort of a nice breakfast or thing at the weekend. But now there's so much choice. It's really good.
Not
on the scale of Melbourne or Sydney, but it's much, much improved.
This is starting to sound more and more like an ad for Perth.
Apparently, you can even get a decent coffee here these days. I don't drink coffee, but my wife does, and that's possible these days.
Okay, that's actually pretty good. Yeah, no, look, I guess some people from Melbourne moved over. That's nice.
I actually think that is what happened.
Yeah, that's it. It's funny. When I was in London, I noticed it there as well. It's like one of the things people from Australia don't realize is how like. Australian coffee is rated highly, like as in Melbourne, it's kind of a thing people know about. So it's like, which you don't realize, but if people are like, oh, it's from Melbourne coffee, it's like actually a thing, which I didn't know until I went over there.
Well, there was even three years ago, my wife and I, we went to LA and we were staying down near Santa Monica near the beach, and people were raving about this particular cafe because of the coffee. And it was an Australian cafe.
Yeah.
And serving Vegemite. And coffee. The flat white had reached America.
Yeah.
Apparently. That's what I mean. But I think even Starbucks does flat whites these days. So obviously it's
Yeah, but I mean, it's Starbucks. You
know? Not the same. Not the same.
It's not the same.
Yeah, I don't. As I say, I don't. I'm more of a tea drinker myself. So being British.
Yeah, no, look, some things just never change. Yeah, okay, actually, one last thing, and this is me just kind of pointing it out, I guess, more than anything else. I just find it funny, like, I noted this while we were talking. You're saying how, like, the guess I made about the culturally genteel worldly thing, and it's funny because, like, I think the best proof of that is that you didn't end up staying in, like, although I guess there was more factors than just you choosing it, but in trading, but you've actually ended up in academia, which I would argue is the most of that genteel attitude to things, if you know what I mean. So, like, as in it's, like, you know what I mean? Like, as in it's more cultural than it is anything else.
It is, although I think universities are, rightly or wrongly, are run more like businesses these days than they were back in the Halcyon days of the 19th century. It's not to say that there's not, in banking, you don't spend time thinking. You certainly do spend a lot of time thinking about positions and what's going on in the world. But you have things move at a faster pace. So in academia, you have more time to sit and think more, maybe more big picture and contemplate things than you do in finance.
Exactly. It's not just your bonus. Your quarterly bonus you've got to have for.
That's right. And one of the reasons I enjoy running is because it gives me time to think and clean my mind. I think that's one of the reasons I don't really listen to much when I run, is because I like to have the time to think.
Mm. No, that's the best kind of thing as well, right? You've got like that runner's high and all that stuff.
Exactly. So you've got the endorphins flowing through you, and it really helps to clear the mind. I think I solve quite a lot of the problems that I'm facing in my research. I solve out on the trails in the Perth Hills. Then the only issue is having to remember the solution by the time you get back to the finish.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Especially if it's technical, that's very... I do love that. So there is something very specifically connected between the boy who read Around the World in 80 Days and then has ended up in Perth running ultra marathons thinking about finance. Like, as in, there's a weird connection there. It's strange, right? I don't know. We have gone for a while, so I should cut it off there. Thanks so much for being on. That was really fun. Is there anything you would want anyone to follow you on or check you on anything at all before we sign off? No. That's okay. That's okay. I'm used to having
I'm not on a fit. I do use social media, but not regularly. So. Mm.
No, that sounds good. All right. Thanks very much for being on.
Not a problem.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.